morning. My name's Miffy. Here we are in the Lungri Tungpa Center Library, the wonderful Lama Zopa Rinpoche behind me, and we're doing class two of this course, Ancient Wisdom for Modern Life. So it's always such a relevant course, a relevant topic for what everybody's been going through. So it's a six-week course, and the main kind of approach for today is how come we have to work on our own mind? How come it's up to us to remove unhappiness and become happy? Why can't everybody else just be nice? Why can't everybody else just treat me better? And then I wouldn't be upset anymore. So kind of the question that kind of wailing that I do in my own mind of why does it have to be me? Why do I have to do it? So why is it that we ourselves need to stop being so reactive? And, why can't we just rely on other people finally treating us better or the world becoming a better place, and then everything would be okay with us? So most of our life we spend, without even realizing that's what we're doing, trying to get comfortable, trying to make things okay, trying to adjust our circumstances, trying to fix this and fix that. Always, I know in my own mind with this thought of, oh, if this just happened, I'd be okay. Or if I just got enough sleep, I'd be better. Or if I just got enough holidays, or if I just had enough classes, or, you know, if the Geshes could finally tour in person, or if I could go to Venice. There's all these ifs. Whereas that's actually like an endemic problem. And how come it doesn't work for us? Because it's like this chasing a rainbow. It just continuously shifts. So whilst we're always looking for our comfort out there, we're really missing out on creating this internal kind of state of mind or peacefulness. So what we're going to look at today is how to start looking within. Just to put things into context, what we've covered so far, last week we talked about the overview of the course, which is these six factors that cause disturbing emotions. Six things that when they come together, all six of them, we have a perfect storm, and the result is unhappiness, stress, angst, fear, loneliness, and also lots of negative responses that we'd be kind of shocked or ashamed about and go, oh, that really wasn't like me. So when all those six factors come together, it's very, very difficult to withstand them. Luckily, when, most of the time, just a few of them are in play, and then we have a chance to guard ourselves against them. But really, when everything comes crashing down, that's because all those six factors are in play, and then it's very, very difficult for us to keep our head above water. So last week, we looked at two of the six factors. One of them, society or culture, our peer group, and what's called kind of bad company, but actually company that brings out the worst in us. So not bad people, but the influence has a negative effect on us. And just social distraction, where it's so easy to waste our time. So detrimental influences or misleading company, it really depends on who we are. So if I'm an alcoholic and all of my friends are also alcoholics or drinkers, that's going to be bad company for me. It doesn't necessarily mean they're bad people, but it's going to be very difficult for me to be able to keep my equilibrium and my, intention not to drink. Also, just with the social distraction, I noticed that a lot of times I've been just attracted to people that entertain me, that I like being with, that are fun or funny. But they may not actually be good people. They might talk behind others' backs. They might run away at the first whiff of trouble. They might borrow all my money and never repay it. All of those things, so that just because someone is nice to be with doesn't necessarily mean that they're a good influence on us. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're mentoring us. So in terms of society, it was just to have a look at who we spend our time with, recognize how that has a big effect on us, and to make sure that we consciously spend time with people that are better people than us, that are more ethical, that are more inspired, more focused, so that that good effect rubs off on us. That we spend time each week with people that bring out the best in us, that challenge us, that kind of lift us up. So I know when I put it that way, you know, if I wasn't at a Dharma center, it'd be a very different story. We also looked at the media, misleading advice, false teachings, fake news, but also just misleading explanations. So lots of philosophy or Western psychology, it's just ideas. None of it's founded in evidence. It's just people's a nice idea to put an acronym together. And a lot of it can really cause harm. If you put your faith in something and you get a diagnosis, you're broken in some way, and you take that entirely on board, it may or may not be right. It just might be that person's opinion, and there's no evidence for it. So, of course, whenever we get a diagnosis about anything, whether it's mental health or physical, we should always seek a second opinion just to verify it. But so much, what do? We just get online and we look up Dr. Google, Google God, and self-diagnose. And we know where that leads, doesn't it? Like, everything's wrong with me. So how to guard our own mind. How to develop a really healthy skepticism. Because we so much want answers that we so yearn for answers and certainty that we just want to believe things. And having our advice based on belief is actually quite dangerous. Also, with the media, in the last, 5 years, there's been more changes in the way that we get our information than there has been in the last 500 years. So this huge upheaval in society and just the sheer deluge of information and the echo chambers from social media means it's very difficult to get good advice or authentic teachings and to be able to check it out and really find if the lineage is valid, if we can rely on it. And so that was the third thing that we talked about last week, was finding a valid refuge. So there's this picture here of a lady with an umbrella. Do you remember the umbrella analogy? That if we really find something that we can put our confidence and trust in, a spiritual path, a spiritual community, mentors, a role model, and we progress like that, then it's like having an umbrella. We're protecting our mind. So instead of having to stop the rain, stop the hail, stop all the catastrophes that are happening in the world that we have very little control over, we can guard our mind. And then with our precious umbrella, we can meet any situation in life with confidence because we are protected. Our equilibrium is not disturbed. So I was just wondering, did you have any questions or comments or anything about that, what we covered last week? Anything kind of stood out for you throughout the week about that? Or if you did the reflection sheets, did you have any feedback about that? Yeah, Daryl.
I did start the reflection sheet, Miffy. So I got up to question 7 so far.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, so I've got a bit of a way to go, but.
Yeah, I mean, they're not difficult questions, but they can be a little confronting, aren't they? And really, I've purposely just put 1 or 2 lines there of space so that the answers have to be short. And it's just a way of helping us to take an internal snapshot to see how we are, because many times we can feel quite demoralized, that something's lacking in us, or that we're doing everything wrong, or, you know, especially if we're tired. But actually, when we look at our environment and our circumstances, it takes a lot of effort. And that all that effort just to keep a calm mind, just to not retaliate, just to keep your focus, all of those, that all takes energy. So, of course, we're quite on the edge a lot of the time. So these worksheets are kind of designed to be as a way of taking a snapshot and then being able to have like an objective view of ourselves and go, oh, yeah, okay, that explains a lot. just got one other person who booked for the class. I'm just going to send them. It only just came through. Here we go. Right. Okay. So let's have a look what we'll cover this week. Today's topics. So we're looking at the next two of the six factors, and these are called the seed and the object. And when these two combine together, we're very likely to have disturbing emotions arise. We're very likely to become agitated or dissatisfied, and then that can lead to a whole lot of other disturbing emotions. So understanding these two, the seed and the object, the difference between a root cause and all of the conditions that cause it to come to fruition. We generally mix these two up. We've got them totally swapped over. And that's why, even though we put in a whole lot of effort to fix things up, they just keep on going wrong. And it's because we're putting our effort not quite in the right place. So this really shows us, when we have a look at the seed and the object, it shows us the internal workings of our experience. In a very realistic manner, which means now suddenly we can do something about it. And instead of always just putting Band-Aids on the situation, we'll be able to put a Band-Aid on as well as find out what caused the problem in the first place. So that really means that we've got the power to change and to change things. So the seed, the root cause, and then the object, and what we're also going to look at is what are called powerful objects. So there are some things that really have a big effect on us, and we've got to guard against those, especially as beginners. It's kind of like if you're an alcoholic, you don't go every day to the pub and go, I can withstand this. We've got to become realistic and give ourselves a break and some support. So how to recognize what are the objects that have a real strong effect on us. So let's do just a little meditation to set our motivation. So having your posture, your back straight, and then relaxing your body, feeling that your body's supported, that your back is like a pile of coins or like a pillar, each one supporting the one above it, really stable. And then the rest of your body supported so you can relax. And notice how you're there in your room, quiet. There may be things going on around you, but you're not kind of getting up and chasing after the sounds or chasing after the car, flying away with the birds. Our body can be still and comfortable in amongst all of the activity of the world. So to our mind, we can just rest our focus or anchor it on the breath, just being aware of the sensation of breathing in and breathing out. And everything else, any other thoughts or feelings that are swimming around, that are arising, just leave them in the periphery. Don't focus on them. Keep the focus just on the breath, breathing in and breathing out, so that your mind too can become still without worrying about everything else going on around you, just leaving it be. And even if there is a little bit of distraction in your mind, that's okay. You are not the distraction. You are not your distraction. You are not your emotions. You're not your worries. All of those things arise in that infinite spaciousness of the mind. And so in that spaciousness, we can really focus our motivation. That by coming to know our own predispositions, being able to recognize the real cause of any problems or suffering, then we can do something about it. And we'll also be able to help others in a way more effective manner. If we recognize the objects that trigger us, we'll be able to have a healthy respect for them. And we'll be able to share our experience with others and help them too. And if we can make this a practice, an internal approach, and develop it, there's no limit to how we can develop. So we can set our sights on complete liberation from the ups and downs of life and full awakening or enlightenment, so we can help everybody else as well. So our motivation can be quite personal, but it can also be very extensive like this as well. So deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. And I have a little reading just to get started from Thupten Chodron. It's a fantastic book called Open Heart, Clear Mind. And the very first chapter, Where is Happiness? Looking closely at our experience. In the course of one day, we experience many emotions. Some emotions, such as genuine love and compassion, are valuable. Others, attachment, anger, closed-mindedness, pride, and jealousy, disturb our mental peace and make us act in ways that disturb others. All disturbing attitudes are based upon the innate assumption that happiness and pain come from outside of us. It seems that other people and things make us happy or miserable. And thus we rely on external objects that we contact through our senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, to make us happy. We have the notion that happiness is located out there in that object, place, or person. And consequently, we try to procure certain things and be near certain people. And similarly, we try to avoid all the objects and people that make us unhappy, because it appears our happiness and unhappiness is coming from them. The view that happiness and unhappiness come from external things and people puts us in a predicament, because we can never completely control the people and things around us. We try to obtain the possessions we want, but we never have enough. continuously disappointed. We search for more and better of whatever it is we think that will bring us happiness. But do we know one rich person who is totally satisfied? Do we know one person who is completely content with their friends and relatives? And likewise, when we think that whenever we have a problem, it's due to an external person or thing. We attribute our emotional problems to the way our parents treated us when we were young. We blame our present dissatisfaction on our employees, relatives, or teachers. And we wish the people around us would learn to treat us better. Others aren't what we want them to be, and we're constantly frustrated in our attempts to make them change. Our lives can become very complicated as we try to make the world be what we want it to be. And unfortunately, the world doesn't cooperate. So don't we know it? So I'm sure you can relate to that. It's a really common situation, isn't it? And it's a really strong habit, looking outside of ourselves. But let's have a look at actually the root causes. And so this is the topic of the seed. So what causes that dissatisfaction or that craving or that frustration in the first place? So the seed, this part of the six factors, isn't a physical seed, but it's a potential in our mind or a readiness in our mind, in our psyche, for a delusion to arise or for a suffering to arise or confusion to arise. So it's our potential or readiness. It's also our potential or readiness to laugh, to be joyous, to appreciate things. So that kind of tendency or potential. And if we think of our mind as like a vast field, and within that field, there are countless seeds. I mean, how can we even count how many are there just in an ordinary external field? But in our mind, countless, countless seeds. Some positive, some negative, some quite exotic. Very strange conditions have to come together for them to sprout. Others running rampant, so common. There's huge momentum. So we don't really know our own measure. What kind of seeds or what kind of readiness do we have in our mind? Because they're all there, just in potential or latent. So they're kind of, I suppose you could say, unconscious or subtle predispositions for things. And we don't really know we have them until they meet their conditions and arise. Otherwise, they're just there. So we're like this vast unknown quantity, not just of the negative things, but also the positive things. People really underestimate their strength and their courage until an extreme situation comes about and they just jump to it. We hear that in the news, don't we, often? And people say, oh, I'm no hero, I just did what anybody would do. But actually, no, it was a very brave thing to do. And that's because a positive seed came to fruition. So just as a little sideline, how do we get those seeds? How did all those potentials, those latent seeds or predispositions, get there in the first place? So this is kind of like the mechanics of the mind. Actions controlled by afflictive mind states. So past actions that are done in ignorance or confusion, when we act on them, even if we're just acting out of kind of reactivity or fear, whatever we do leaves an imprint on our mind. It's a seed of karmic instinct. There's a resonance or an imprint that's left on our mind stream. And then later on, given the right conditions, those imprints are triggered and we experience the resultant suffering or happiness. So it's a little bit like, you know, a film with a negative. You take the photo and you might develop those negatives straight away, or it might be many weeks or months later. And not only that, but you can make many, many copies. So we've got like countless of these imprints on our mind. So what this means is, like in my own experience, I thought I was a decent and fine person, but I don't really know what kind of person I am until I'm put in kind of an extreme situation. So I remember when I first moved to Melbourne years and years ago, and I moved to a suburb, East Brunswick, which was really full of, I don't know what nationality it was, but I just remember being out on the street at dusk and looking up and down and being the only woman on the street. And so there was a lot of kind of prejudice and misogyny in this neighborhood that women weren't even out on the street. And I had a really negative effect, response to that. So there's kind of nothing like bigotry or prejudice to bring out the bigotry and prejudice within me. So I was completely reactive about that and became quite negative and quite blamey. So there's not, we kind of don't know our own measure until someone starts insulting us and we notice that we just insult them back. You know, and all the while I think, oh, I'm an okay person. But given a negative situation, it triggers a negative seed in me and I just respond back in kind. You know, someone's yelling, yell back. Someone's rude, rude back. How often when someone's rude do we become more gracious? So this happens so fast, doesn't it? This dynamic. But what's happening is a situation is triggering a negative seed within our mind and boom, it comes to fruition. And I mean, this can on a much larger time scale catch us out as well, because for instance, if we have I remember reading a story about a junkie who was kicking the heroin habit and was in New York somewhere, and he managed to get off heroin, change his life around, and everything was fine for about 10, 12 years. And then they must have had, I think it might have been when there was a petrol shortage, and suddenly everybody had to use public transport, the train to get to work because no one could line up for the petrol stations anymore. He went down into the subway, and by the time he came back out of the subway, he was a junkie again. So what had happened? He'd gone down into the subway, and all of those circumstances where the dealers are that he'd managed to avoid for the last 12 years, right there. And so, of course, the force of habit found his dealer, shot up. So this kind of shows that if we don't deal with the seed or the potential within our mind and just deal with the situation, the circumstances, we are beholden to the circumstances. It's a start, but it's not the cure. The cure is to remove that readiness or potential in our mind, that then when we go down into that tube station, we are free mentally. We won't get caught out. So if we just remove the habit but not the seed, we're still in danger. So this kind of leads us to being able to differentiate between causes and conditions. So often we might think, oh, that the cause of becoming a junkie again, starting using again, was going down into that subway. That's often what we think. It's the subway's fault, the petrol strike's fault, the dealer's fault. But actually, those things are what we call conditions, or in colloquial term, triggers. What the cause is what we call a substantial cause or a root cause. So how can we tell the difference between these two things? How can we actually identify them in our own life? So here we are. A substantial cause must be of a similar type or substance and consistently bring a similar result. So a substantial cause or a root cause. And I mean, the hint is there in the term substantial or substance. And how we can identify it is by thinking it turns into the result. The substantial cause turns into the result. So I'll give you a really easy example first, and then we can have a look at how that works with our mind and emotions. So for instance, what's the cause of Miffy's desk? You can't see, but I've got this nice wooden table that I'm on in the library. So the substantial cause of the desk, the thing that turned into the desk. So this desk here, it's made of wood. So the substantial cause was a tree. The wood from that tree turned into the desk. So that's the substantial cause, the substance. The cooperative cause was the builder who made the desk. So we can't say that the builder turned into the desk, can we? The builder was an integral part of it. So called a cooperative cause. Without the builder, that tree would have still been standing there. Builder came along, turned that tree into the desk. And then there's a third thing, the conditions. So just having the builder there isn't enough. We have to have all the conditions. So all the tools, the time, getting good paychecks, so you're going to do it, the skills. So all of those conditions. So all those three things come together, and then we get a desk. So that's fairly simple, isn't it? And we can see that the root cause, or the substantial cause, is that tree. But when it comes to our emotions, we get this completely mixed up. So I've got here, it's an old internet meme. So what's the cause of Eddie's annoyance? Eddie going, As you often know, I love watching late night television. And so if I'm watching late night TV, Eddie might be going, shut up, and get really cranky. And so Eddie will think, it's my fault. I've got the telly on, and that's why he's cranky. But if we're looking at this causes and conditions, do I turn into Eddie's crankiness? I don't. It's impossible, isn't it? So it can't be the substantial cause. So actually, the cooperative cause, me, I turn on the telly. Yes, I turn on the telly, but I don't turn into his annoyance. I'm a contributing factor for sure. And the substantial cause is that readiness to be cranky. So that's there. That's like a seed that's there the whole time, latent. And Eddie might think, oh, he's, you know, quite a fine, happy human being. But then I come along and turn on the TV late at night, and now suddenly, rah! So what's the trigger? All the conditions, the noise, the flickering light. That all comes together. I actually turn on the TV and Eddie gets cranky. So now, can you see what's happening here? so many times, whoever turns on the TV, we go, it's your fault. You did it. You made me cranky. But that cannot be the substantial cause, because that person who made you cranky didn't turn into your crankiness. That process happened in your mind. So what turned into the crankiness, what turned into the distress or the angst or the dissatisfaction was that seed, that potential in your mind. And it might have been there for years and we didn't know till the right trigger came along and everything came together. So does that make sense? Do you have a question or a comment about that yet? This difference between substantial cause and conditions or triggers? Daryl?
A lot of sense. I've never looked at it that way. It's fascinating.
You're right. It is fascinating. And it is like doing a whole U-turn. And literally we are doing a U-turn because we look outside of ourselves all the time. And then with this, we're looking, we're screeching around the corner and looking within. So I think what we can do to help us recognize what's going on is when we have that urge to blame, you did it, instead of kind of getting all judgmental, notice the direction of our focus, and the direction's always outwards. And that can never be the root cause. Yes, it can be a contributing condition. And many times we may actually, we should leave the situation if we can't withstand it. But the blame we've got to look within and place on those seeds and what caused those seeds. So, yeah, it's quite a different approach. And this is really how the Buddhist psychology is quite radical, because it takes this very deep dive in. Now, Western psychology looks at triggers and what we can do about that, but it never looks deeper still to that readiness in our mind, because we can't control all the triggers in the world. You know, nowadays we've got trigger warning, so you can't talk about anything. So how are you even going to deal with your problems if you can't talk about them? So let's do a little reflection now on this, just to bring it into our experience. I'll give you some examples. So again, just bringing your focus inwards. And let's look in our own mind to see the readiness that we have to engage in positive actions, destructive ones, pleasant or unpleasant feelings. And where we can start is by just reflecting, do we know our own predispositions? Can we predict which emotions will arise? What kind of responses we'll have in a situation? Do we surprise ourselves in a positive way or a negative way? How well do we know ourselves? So let's think of a time when we might have done something unskillful and we think, I've acted out of character. I acted badly, or I'm ashamed about it. And we tend to say, oh, I wasn't myself. Might have said, oh, I had the flu, or I was tired, I was sleep deprived. We might have just come out of anesthetic and said some really weird things. So when we say that we've acted out of character, that came from, that's a result of a seed within our own mind, but a latent seed. We didn't know it was there. And then the circumstances come along and trigger it. I might have thought I was a tolerant person, but given the right situation, negative seeds ripen and I too become prejudiced and bigoted. None of us are angry at the moment, but that doesn't mean that the potential for anger is gone. That seed of anger is still in our mind stream. It's still there as a latency. And we just need to meet the proper conditions. Maybe some renovations start next door, a dog starts barking on the other side, the ice cream van comes around with its inane tune, someone starts an argument, we get a bit uncomfortable in our seat, and then something breaks the camel's back and we'll go, that's what did it. So while we are calm now, we can recognize that's largely due to our favorable conditions, but that potential for aggravation and anger is there in our mind. We may also underestimate our qualities. Can you think of a situation where you were able to rise to the occasion, where you were able to help, where you surprised yourself with your courage? Maybe where you stood up for someone, or you spontaneously helped somebody. That readiness in your mind of compassion and kindness. So recognizing how our mind is like a vast field full of potential, positive and negative. Make a determination to put into place positive conditions so that the very best seeds will ripen. And to do some internal weeding, gardening, to make sure that those negative seeds, when they ripen, they don't get out of control. And then nice deep breath in through the nose. Out through the mouth. So hopefully a little meditation or focus like that is helpful to kind of bring this theory into a bit of experience, because we've all had these experiences. We've just got to put it together. Now, there are some really practical things that we can do to get started with this. What to do? So first off, to recognize that when we encounter difficulties, these trigger negative latent seeds within our mind. So the difficulties aren't the cause, they're the trigger. So even if we just start training in our words, instead of the blame, recognizing, oh, that's the conditions, but it's not the cause. Difficult people, angry people, they're not the cause of my anger and discomfort. They're the trigger. When we blame others, that just compounds our suffering. It makes it worse because we give away all of our power. If we say it's your fault, now suddenly you have the power and I can do nothing about it. It's this terrible compromise, you know, that we make. Part of this also recognizing that difficulties trigger our latent seeds is that many people can be in the same situation, but they all react differently. So, for instance, COVID, the pandemic, how people have responded to being in lockdown has been vastly different. Some people took the opportunity to make crazy videos, got really creative, lots of TikTok videos. Other people felt really isolated. Other people felt relieved. Now they could focus on reading really good books, the inner life, decluttering their house. Same situation, but the response was vastly different. So that shows that we can't blame the pandemic for how we feel. The pandemic is a trigger for our potentials to come to fruition. It's the condition. Also, it can't be a substantial cause because the pandemic didn't turn into my loneliness. The pandemic's the trigger for it. So just kind of again and again, trying to recognize this and even change the way we speak about it or describe it to ourselves. So difficulties are not the cause, they are the mirror. So when we're experiencing difficulties and we have that tendency to blame, to recognize, oh, no, it's a mirror of what's going on inside my mind, inside my heart. And while that can be quite confronting, it might appear really terrible at first, that terribleness is a distortion. We have the courage to look within, we're actually going to be able to do something about it. If we remove the seed, our mind will remain calm. A pandemic can happen and our mind will remain calm. We won't lose our equilibrium. So this is a real power. This is something that we can do. So we have very little control over people, how they treat us, over situations, the weather, the pandemic, the politics, the neighbours. We have very little control over our health. We certainly can't control it the way that we want to. It's usually just a downward slope. And we have no control over when our death will come, which can cause us a lot of anxiety. So all of these things, we do try and control, don't we? How much energy do we put into trying to control other people? Saying, no one talks to me like that. Control other situations. Worrying about when we're going to die. We can't control those. What we can control is our response, how we respond to the world. That we have complete control over. So why did I put up a picture of Sanctuary's here, sneakers? Well, that's because of this beautiful story that, in our path through life, we can either try and cover the whole world with leather or we cover our feet. So we can try and smooth our path, get rid of all the rocks, make everything wonderful and conducive, the whole world like that, or we can just put shoes on our feet. When we have shoes on our feet, we can walk over any terrain. We're protected. We can, bounce along. It's fine. So this is this total change of attitude. Instead of trying to control everyone and everything outside of us, that's like trying to cover the whole world, make it smooth. It's impossible. How much energy do we spend trying to do that? But we can protect our mind. We can cover our own feet, protect our own feet. And that gives us freedom. Then we can bound around over the rocks and actually have fun. So it gives us back our power. What we can do is to try and create positive inner conditions in our own mind to try and help whatever positive seeds that we have, that they're the ones that ripen first, not the negative ones. So how do we do that? Really easy. Every morning, adjust your motivation. Before you leave the house, bring some awareness to the purpose of the day. Preferably actually before you even get out of bed, as you open your eyes. Instead of just having all the worries and the momentum of the day crowd upon you, ask the question, what is the purpose of my life? And a very simple way to set our motivation, the most basic, easy, simple way, nothing to do with religion or anything, is whenever possible, I'm going to help. I'm going to be kind, show compassion to others, help out wherever I can. And if I can't help, at least I'm not going to harm. So that covers everything, doesn't it? We even if we can't leave the house, so we can't go out and help anybody, but we cannot harm. By practicing social distancing, we are practicing non-harm. We are protecting others. That's a thing, it's an activity. And even if we can't say anything to help somebody, we can make sure we don't say anything to upset them or harm them. So this is such a great way to just remember, oh yeah, that's right. Today when I leave the house, whenever possible, I'm going to try and help. So then we're ready. We're already primed. We don't have to keep on remembering it throughout the day. And I'm not going to harm. And that means that when push comes to shove and someone kind of gets an angry face at me, I don't just automatically react, but I go, oh, hang on. I'm not going to harm. I'm not going to respond to anger with anger. I'm just going to keep calm, remove myself from the situation. It's really simple and it's just a dynamite practice. And then on top of that, if we enhance all of our positive activities, so if we try and do constructive activities, read Dharma books, spend time with people that bring out the best in us, watch inspirational movies, create merit, keep a journal, do a course like this, all of these positive activities become really good conditions for us. We can put in place positive conditions. That means it's more likely that our virtues will flourish. So even if we live in a very difficult situation, if we have an unharmonious family life, we've got to find a place where we can create some peace and calm for ourselves so we can enhance positive activities and a positive internal environment. So hopefully that just gives you a starting point for this, because getting rid of those negative seeds, that's a really big thing. That's a lifelong activity. And meanwhile, we've got to just give ourselves a break and try and put in place positive internal environment. So it means it more likely that our positive emotions and responses will come to the fore. So just as an aside, what happens to the seeds? Well, negative seeds, all those negative potentials in our mind, the only way we can fully eradicate them is with the wisdom understanding reality, or the wisdom in Buddhist terminology, understanding emptiness. Developing wisdom that directly sees how things are means that all of our confusions disappear, which means all of the causes for our unhappiness disappear. That's the only way to get rid of those negative seeds forever. But until we develop that wisdom, what do we do? What we do is use the four opponent powers to stop them ripening. So the seeds are still there, but they can't ripen. So that's a good holding pattern. It's a good strategy to have. We might have lots of weeds in our field, but they don't necessarily sprout. We can do something about it so that they're kind of inoculated. The other thing too that we can keep in mind is that once a negative seed ripens, then it's over. So a negative seed ripens as an experience, an unpleasant experience. So we get the flu, fall over and hurt ourselves, someone yells at us, we have this negative experience. Once that experience is over, it's finished, and we can at least we can say, good, that seed's gone. It's over. So that's like the seed sprouts and then it's gone. So that's the only way to get rid of them. The similar kind of process happens with positive seeds, though. So when we have positive seeds, they ripen into pleasant experiences. So everything that we experience, that we enjoy, that is a result of a positive seed ripening in our mind. So in a way, it's like we're spending our money. We're just spending it. If you're like me and you spend and spend and spend, you got a hole in your, you know, fire in your pocket until it's gone, then what? So the thing is that we have to reinvest our positive energy. So when we're feeling good, that's the time to reinvest that energy by doing more virtuous things, more positive things, actually investing in your good qualities and making them stronger. When you have that window of opportunity and that energy to do it, not when you're kind of already beaten down and tired. So when we have the energy, reinvest it by planting more positive seeds, becoming more familiar with all your good qualities, with your kindness, and actually practicing it. And then if we have those conducive conditions, we can create some kind of harmonious feeling in our mind. We're not at civil war anymore. We can do some positive things that bring out the best in us, rather than just kind of consuming all of our good experiences like in this materialistic way, then instead of being a downward spiral, it's an upward spiral. When we're happier, it's more likely for good things to happen to us. It's easier for us to be kind to others. And when we're kind to others, it makes us happier. So we can get this positive momentum going as well. All right, so before we go on, any questions about that, about the seeds, before we go on to the object part of things? Yeah.
Just a comment, Miffy, like I struggle with overeating a lot. And I know it's some trigger in there somewhere, and I just can't seem to put my finger on it. And I get overwhelmed by my sort of, you know, I get hangry, but I get beyond hangry. Like I'm really, really angry, and only when I eat something do I feel satiated. And then I feel bad because I didn't really need it or I wasn't hungry as such.
Yep. Yeah, so overeating is one of those perfect storm where all six factors are at play. And that's why it's so overwhelming and why it has such a downward spiral to it. So the first thing is to stop blaming yourself for it. Number one, just take the pressure off yourself. And if we are going to blame, we've got to blame the right thing, which is the disturbing emotions and the confusion, not you. So number one, that. Often when we blame, we go, oh, it's me, it's my fault. And the me we're pointing to is the one, the good one, you know, the one that's the sincere one that's trying to put in all of this energy. That's wrong. So if you have that impetus to blame, put it on the right place, which is all of the confusion and disturbing emotions and mistaken attitudes that created the negative seeds. That one we can blame. So, you know, we have this thing, we have, all of us have within us seeds of dissatisfaction and craving. And in the pandemic, the perfect condition comes along, lockdown, and everybody put on weight. So I got a friend who's a massage therapist, and she said, "Oh, Miffy, everybody has put on kilos because of the pandemic, just across the board." So the condition comes along. Now, most of those people, you know, they all had that seed of dissatisfaction, but the condition of lockdown wasn't there. And so you think you're fine. Conditions change, and now suddenly a new seed sprouts and we all start overeating. So me too. I mean, I stacked on 10 kilos from the pandemic. Thanks, pandemic. But that's a trigger because the pandemic didn't turn into my kilos, did it? So the thing that's happening is to, number one, recognize that that seed of dissatisfaction is there in our mind. And then the pandemic and then food. They're there. Now, if we didn't have food, then it wouldn't be a problem. If we're in a country where we're starving, or if we didn't, if we were reliant on Centrelink benefits and actually, you know, couldn't afford enough food, then we may not have this problem. So those are the conditions. So the thing is to now start looking, yeah, within our own mind. And that is a long-term proposition. And in the next couple of classes, we're going to have a look at the other factor that kicks it all off, which is what's called inappropriate attention. And that's the attention that goes, that food will satiate me. So that's a whole nother class. That's a real biggie of how to deconstruct that one, but we can. Meanwhile, with this one, if we get the context that it's the seed, that's the root problem, then we can prime ourselves. This is a marathon, not a sprint. This is a long-term thing. We can just take our time and get a really good strategy in there. And the other thing is to take some real practical measures about the related object. So that means all of those triggers. So that means the food that we have in the house, the food that we see when we go out of the house, the circumstances of how much we're in lockdown, how much we're not, all of that kind of thing. Because the delusions or those seeds can't actually ripen without meeting an object. Otherwise, they're just latent there. So the object is that trigger that ripens the seed. So if I'm an alcoholic and I manage to have friends that none of them drink and I don't ever go to a pub and I don't walk past the bottle shop, it's very easy for me to forget all about it, you know, after I put in that initial strategy of refraining. But if I lived next door to a pub or a bottle shop, it would be a very different thing because that trigger would be there all the time. So we are bombarded with advertising. Advertising has very skillful psychology. It knows the exact triggers to put in front of our eyes to ripen a seed of longing, dissatisfaction, craving, anger. Like they say in the Gruen Transfer, what advertising does is it creates a problem and then it sells you the solution. So the advertising, it shows us that problem, that seed within us, and then it says, oh, but this will help, this external thing. And of course it can't, because those external things, they're just the triggers and the conditions. They're not dealing with that root cause at all. Now, I had a little thing to read to you from Lama Yeshe, actually. So this is from a book called Wisdom Energy, Basic Buddhist Teachings. And actually, there's one chapter in here, chapter 4, How Delusions Arise, that goes through these six factors. Just short and sweet. So this is Lamyeshi talking about the seeds and then the object. So the seeds. The fundamental cause of the deluded mind is the karmic imprint left on your consciousness by previous non-virtuous or destructive actions. Because of past actions done in ignorance and motivated by desire or hatred or any of the other delusions, various imprints or seeds of karmic instinct have been planted in your mind. And when the conditions are right, these seeds ripen and the deluded mind rises again. The object itself is the second factor that encourages this ripening. Most of the time, when the object is near you and the karmic imprint is in your mind, bang, delusion arises. A good example is when you go shopping, or I could say when you look at to open the fridge door. The object is there on the shelf. Through your sense perception, your eye comes into contact with it. And before you're aware of what is happening, your mind sinks with attachment into the object. It can happen in a very sneaky way, and it can be extremely difficult to separate your mind from the desired object. Don't we know it? My powers of visualization for packets of Tim Tams knows no bounds. Perfect. I mean, how embarrassing is that? You know, my visualization of the Buddha is all fuzzy, but the Tim Tam packet, the texture of the chocolate, you know, I can feel it on my fingertips. So there you go. Your mind sinks with desire into the object. Your hand automatically moves to your pocket or to the shelf, find some money, and you buy even before you know what you're doing. It's so simple, isn't it? Thus, when the deluded subject, us, the mind, comes into relationship with the appropriate object, superstition explodes like an atomic bomb. So Lamyeshi calls this superstition. What is superstitious is that assumption that having the food will satiate me. That's the superstition. It's a chimera. It's a really strong feeling and it's completely incorrect. That feeling is propelled by habit and a mistaken attitude and all of these things. So we're going to go into that for the rest of the class. But right now today, we're looking at the very basics, that the trigger, the object out there, and our potential to crave it in here. So what's really interesting is that Lamyeshi called them related objects. So it's not just random objects. It's a related object. So here we have the objects may differ, but our feelings are universal. So I've got a picture here of just someone listening to music. So we like music, don't we? We know the music that we like. That's true. But the type of music we like can be completely different. What some people love, other people loathe and detest. Everybody's music tastes are varied, aren't they? And most of us would say it's a music taste. It's only a really prejudiced person will go, heavy metal is bad and classical music is good. Or industrial music is good and flute music is disgusting. Most of us know it's a matter of taste. So we do have this kind of wisdom already, that we know it's not the music itself. It's our taste that makes us enjoy it or not. So there it is, right there. We have that wisdom. It's not the object itself that is good or bad. It's our response to it. And this also frees us up. It gives us a lot of power, because imagine if we tried to ban all the music that we didn't like. which some people have tried to do, haven't they? Got it totally around the wrong way. We'll just ban the devil's music, or we'll ban heavy metal, or we'll poo-poo classical music, or whatever it is. We try and get rid of the external object. So a couple of things happen here. One is that you can't actually ban everything. As we know, someone will keep something precious in the basement to come out 20 years later. And number two, even if you did manage to ban all the music that you didn't like, you still have that potential in your mind. That hasn't gone. And what normally happens is it just swims over to some other object. And then we start not liking, I don't know, the barking dogs. Try and ban all dogs. It's like, no. And then we'll ban the cicadas that make all of that noise. And then even if you ban all the noise in the world, you've still got the noise of the blood going around in your body. So trying to control those objects out there is just a complete losing game. So the thing is to recognize, well, what are our related objects? What are the things that trigger me the most? And we can relax to recognize there's no ultimate good or bad. There's no good music or bad music. It's a matter of taste. It's a matter of individual experience. And there is no good or bad thing inherently out there either. It's how we interpret it. So once we start thinking like that, it gives us incredible courage and freedom. So let's have a look at some powerful objects, because out of everything out there, some things we're quite neutral about, but some definitely trigger us more than others. So these are power objects or related objects. And as beginners, these are ones that it is important that we try and give ourselves some space. Okay, so powerful objects, things like addictions. Physical addictions, drugs, alcohol, cigarettes, painkillers, they are very powerful objects. Addictions that aren't physical, but they're neurological, gambling, hoarding, social media addiction. So those kind of activities have a powerful effect on us, and we need to acknowledge that. Whilst we're in denial, you know, saying, oh, I could give it up whenever I wanted to. We've all heard that, or perhaps we've even said it. We put ourselves in danger. So to really recognize, okay, these things are a real big trigger for me. So, for instance, with collecting or hoarding, that is a universal problem, but not everybody has that as a problem because not everybody has the money or the opportunity to collect stuff. If we're really poor and if there aren't storage facilities and there aren't op shops everywhere, we can't actually become a hoarder. But given the right conditions, we might. So, I mean, one of the boom industries in Western cities is just paid for storage because we can't get rid of our stuff. We just go put it in storage somewhere. So to kind of recognize that these addictions, that they play out in our mind, and to give them their due, to really have this kind of healthy respect for that power that they have. So we might have a addiction to some form of drug or alcohol or something like that, and kind of expect ourselves to be able to just, you know, kick the habit with mind power alone. But we've got to start very practically by keeping some distance between these powerful objects that overwhelm us. Otherwise, it's a really uphill battle. And so for, say, addictions with food, is to just make sure that whatever you bring into the house is healthy. And whatever junk food you eat, it's outside of the house. That's a good start. It might mean that everything inside the house to eat is really boring, but it is a helpful start. Okay, the next one, places. Places also have a powerful effect on us. Sacred sites, when we visit sacred sites, even if we don't know that they're sacred sites or not, it still has a psychological effect on us. When we go into cathedrals or temples, we feel different. It moves us. And so this can be really helpful, because when we're feeling quite down and we don't have the energy to pull ourselves up, we can go to a place like we can now, to a Lungri Tongpa Center, to a Dharma Center, to a cathedral, and experience the power of that place, and it helps us. So whenever I've been traveling to other cities, I try and go to every single cathedral that I can. They don't always have Dharma centers. I try and visit every Dharma center that I can as well. But I just love going into those places of space and beauty and peace. The other thing to be aware of with place is that we associate events in our life with place. So if you broke up with someone in a restaurant, you probably won't go back to that restaurant again, because it'll bring everything back. And I know my mother, when she divorced from my father, she actually had to move city, because so many places in Melbourne were associated with arguments that it was just awful. You know, she couldn't go to anywhere that she liked anymore. So she was just like, let's just go to a new city. Also, massacre sites like Port Arthur, for instance. If we're feeling quite down and vulnerable and then we go and visit Port Arthur, what kind of effect is that going to have on us? Because the resonance of what's happened in a place is still there. If we go to massacre sites like near Byron Bay, massacre site for Indigenous Australians, that also has a psychological effect on us, even if we don't know that it happened there. So we need to give due respect to the places that we go to. Other powerful objects, this wonderful term, it's a Japanese term, kawaii. So this is to do with cuteness, and it's usually when something really cute and fluffy and cuddly carries our hope. For instance, with the Olympics, you know, they always have a mascot and it's always cute. And that kind of cuteness, what it does is it helps us connect with a feeling aspect, or with a vulnerability, with our hopes and aspirations. When people are sick, you know, often we'll take them flowers and we'll take them a cute, cuddly teddy into the hospital. So why do people do this? We just naturally do this because we need to reconnect with kindness and vulnerability and feeling safe. And how we do that is through an object. You know, you give a cuddly thing to a kid, they cuddle it, and all of those feelings come sweeping through. So kawaii recognizes this and uses it to help us. What we do also with kawaii, we do that with our pets, don't we? We cuddle our pets and it has that same effect on us. So to actually recognize this, instead of kind of being a bit condescending about it, we can recognize this as a powerful thing. And in Japan, they really did. So after the tsunami, there was one kawaii kind of little black cat or white cat or something, I can't remember now, that they gave out to all the kiddies. And it had this really powerful psychological effect on them of helping them heal. Time is also a powerful object. when a time runs rolls around again, an anniversary of something, an anniversary of something really positive, but usually it's an anniversary of something quite negative, the day that someone close to us died. For women that have had an abortion that they didn't want to or felt really badly about, every time that day or that time rolls around, their mood will completely sink. So I've noticed this with people that they'll get quite down for a couple of weeks and they won't even know why. It might have been years and years ago, but it's just this anniversary is rolling around and the seasons are changing and all the associations come in and all of that sadness comes floating back. So if we know this is going to happen, we can prepare. We can be a little kinder to ourselves, a little less impatient. Give ourselves some time to just sit with it and recognize what's going on instead of forcing ourselves to barrel on through the world. Seasonal changes can make us quite nostalgic, and hormonal changes. So every month when you have a period or when you have postnatal depression, these hormonal changes that are cyclic and that come around, when they do, if you're not aware that's what's happening, you might think, oh my God, there's something wrong with me. So these are powerful objects. They have an effect on our life and we can't actually do anything about them. But what we can do is bring awareness to them. And holy objects. So holy objects also are powerful. When we're in the presence of holy relics or Buddha statues, or when we hear beautiful hymns or the Lama's chanting, that has an effect on us from our eyes, from our ears, in our nervous system. When we are in the presence of living beings like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, we feel different in the same room as them. We feel different even when they're on the telly in our lounge room. Those the mantras and the hymns, they're a lot more than just belief or understanding, because they have an effect on animals as well. Animals don't have any belief in this or that religion, and yet they are affected by hearing mantras. So the power of holy objects, we can use that to help us. So that's just my kind of collection of things that I've noticed that have more power over us, these external things or external conditions that it's really worth our while acknowledging. And what we can do, the ones that affect us negatively, keep a respectful distance from them. Like, give yourself a break and just don't go down the lolly aisle. Just don't buy those sweeties. Don't buy the Tim Tams. And if you do buy them, then as you're walking out, put them in the Oz Harvest box and give them to somebody. So some kind of rules like that, a respectful distance from dangerous objects. This isn't the ultimate solution, but we have to start here to create some space, a safe place for ourselves. And if we're a gambler, don't go into the casino, don't go online and gamble. Just ban yourself from those sites. And gamblers try and do that, don't they? They try and ban themselves after a certain amount of time. When I gave up drinking, I stopped going to pubs, absolutely had to stop. And I had to be very careful every New Year's Eve that I surrounded myself with people that weren't drinkers. Respectful distance from dangerous objects. To encourage ourselves to abide in what's called mental solitude. So to be able to spend time with ourselves without distractions, without entertainment, to be able to sit with ourselves without civil war in our own head. Abiding in mental solitude means being content with less. So instead of always grasping for more and more of those things out there, to kind of trick yourself and go, you know what? What I have is enough. It's enough. It's not perfect, but it's enough. One way that we can create mental solitude is to have a physical place where we can have quiet and calm. And then in that place, not take our devices with us, our online whatevers, the phones and music, just to be able to spend some time being quiet without external agitation. Freeing ourselves from the attention economy, everything that's grasping our attention, that's reminding us of our seeds of dissatisfaction and craving and aggravation. So give ourselves a break and free ourselves from that attention economy by creating some external solitude as well. Because Lama Zofa Rinpoche says, the real holiday is a mind free from delusion. So we've all had a yearning for a holiday, haven't we? We've all just gone, oh, I really need a holiday. Or we've looked forward to a holiday. So what is that impetus? When we're craving a holiday, what are we actually craving? So actually, we're craving some peace. Aren't we? We're craving a break and some rest. And then we think it'll come from the holiday. Now, it may or may not come from the holiday. Holidays can be really stressful. So when we have that yearning for a holiday, actually what we're really yearning for is mental solitude. So recognizing that the real holiday is a mind free from delusion. So when we go on holiday, we actually create some conditions where we can have solitude, peace. Don't fill it up with more stuff. And then we'll have the physical break, which is really important, just to kind of get that staring into space look and everything quiets down. And then you sleep for a few days and then your mind is refreshed, and then you can sit there without the attention economy. And that's actually nourishing. The other thing to do, make sure we spend time with people that bring out the best in us. So that's like a positive related object. There are many people that bring out the worst in us. They awaken or trigger all of our negative seeds. That's just a given. So one thing we must do is at least once each week, if not each day, spend time with people that bring out the best in you. And if you don't know anyone like that, then we've got to find some videos like of Geshe Zopa or His Holiness, and spend time with them. So Geshe Zopa said this wonderful thing that when he's doing the housework, he puts His Holiness on the telly, you know, on YouTube, and just has that in the background as company. So he's respectful, but he's also relaxed about it, and we can be too. We don't have to be all, oh, I have to sit down in meditation posture to listen to His Holiness. We can have His Holiness as company while we go about our day. And how can you be depressed then? And the last thing to do with related objects is to acknowledge milestones. So what do I mean by that? It's that many times, like with anniversaries of things, it's often anniversaries of distressing things. And how many times those milestones, when something big and important happens, do we acknowledge them? So someone turns 50, or someone gets the job that they want, or graduates from school, or gets married or has a divorce, or moves city, completes a course of study, completes the Lamrim Chenmo. whatever these important things are that happen to us, it's important to acknowledge that with some form of ritual, to spend the time, bring your awareness to it, have a little party, give a little speech about it, thank the people that helped you. So then those milestones, those significant events in our life take predominance instead of all the traumas in our life, which are the ones that take predominance at the moment. So we've got to be kind of proactive about that. And Australians are a little bit embarrassed, a little bit sheepish about milestones. But even if we do it in an Australian informal way, it's important that we do. Even if we just have a little party in our garden with two or three people, or even if we just sit down with the cat and write something down. So we've had quite a deep journey into seed and object today, how they work together. This is quite unique to a Buddhist understanding, Buddhist psychology, of how we interact with the world. And the biggest thing that we do is mixing up causes and conditions, and that's such a habit. So even if we just start questioning that habit, that's a really good start. And to make our life easy, avoid those objects that overwhelm us. Just say no, no to the hand. And the really good things, the things that you would acknowledge with other people, acknowledge with yourself too in some way. Even if you keep a milestones diary or something. You know, people that are watching their weight, they weigh themselves and they write it down. And then when you have a good result, you acknowledge it. You don't just berate yourself for the bad things. You acknowledge the good ones. So it's like we've got to be kind to ourselves and encourage ourselves. Okay. Last questions before we finish.
No questions, Miffy, just thank you. When you said to me, you know, don't blame yourself, that really drove a nail in. I was sort of, you know.
Yeah.
So be kinder to myself and work on it.
That's right. So encourage Daryl, encourage all of your good qualities, because they're there. And as beginners, we need encouragement. And then blame, that's right, blame in the right place. So blame the delusions, and we are not our delusions. And then at least, so that's a much more conducive environment. It's a much more peaceful environment in our mind. So, you know, as beginning steps, I think there's a lot that we can do straight away. So let's dedicate that everything we've talked about, that we can have realizations, we can bring it into our life. And that as we do so, it's not just for ourselves, but everybody is in the same boat. Everybody gets tripped up by this just like us. So if we're able to overcome this kind of mix-up that we have between causes and conditions, if we're able to do that in our own life, we'll be able to help others. So our own personal struggles with our addictions and with our habits and with our, you know, the power objects that affect us, that's our personal struggle. But if we're able to do something about that, we'll be able to help other people in a really effective way. So, you know, something to really aspire to, and we can go even further than that, to become completely liberated from those problems and help liberate everybody else as well. So that can give us a huge amount of energy for the work. We'll dedicate for our own success, for the benefit of ourselves and others. Have a wonderful week. Enjoy your new reflections. And it'd be great to hear how you go. See, so next week we're going to have a look at the next factor, which is the attention, so that superstition that Lama Yeshe mentioned, how that comes into play to really cause a problem, and how we can dismantle our disappointment and suffering and develop a sense of equanimity. So I hope to see you next week. Have a great morning.